Baby Steps Toward Peace in Ukraine, Friday, April 18th. This is The World. I'm Aaron Schachter in for Marco Werman. A day after a deal is reached to calm tensions in Ukraine, not much progress on the ground. In eastern Ukraine, this reporter says pro-Russia activists aren't budging.
They say they're not going anywhere, and the reason why is they simply don't trust the other side. They don't recognize the government in Kiev.
And later, an Uzbek novelist remembers the impact Gabriel Garcia Marquez's stories had on his gray Soviet upbringing.
Marquez was the first who brought the color in this world.
Plus, extreme cave explorers and why they love plunging deep underground.
They actually love the feeling of being surrounded by rock, of that kind of womb-like feeling of having close contact with the earth.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-Mile Run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Aaron Schachter in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. You could call it a baby step towards peace. I'm talking about the agreement between Ukraine and Russia to try and calm tensions along their shared border. It calls for all protesters in Ukraine to disarm and leave the government buildings they've occupied. But here's the problem. They won't go. The leader of the pro-Russia protesters in eastern Ukraine says they're staying put until Ukraine's interim government resigns. The CBC's Derek Stoffel is in Donetsk in eastern Ukraine. Derek, you've been speaking to pro-Russian activists there. What are they saying?
Well, they're not going anywhere. They continue their occupation of the main regional government building here in Donetsk. I was just there a little while ago. And just to give you a sense of what it actually looks like, this is a big multi-story government administration building, a sort of run-of-the-mill Soviet times looking building. But what they've done is they've erected this large barricade outside, tires and scrap metal, pretty much anything they could find. And they let us inside the barricade where, you know, people were, leaders were talking on the stage. In Russian, trying to, you know, keep up the fight was the message there. And we didn't speak to any of these leaders themselves, but the people on the ground, these pro-Russian supporters, they say they're not going anywhere. And the reason why is they simply don't trust the other side. They don't trust the Ukrainians. And as you mentioned, they don't recognize the government in Kiev. They say it is illegitimate. And as a result, they say that the government, this new government, the interim government in Kiev, is actually occupying the presidential offices, the parliament. So they say that the government needs to abandon these government buildings before they leave their positions here. So they're firmly entrenched for the foreseeable future.
Derek, did you get the impression that the guys you talked to were sort of the leaders of their own movement, or were they taking orders from someone else?
Certainly taking orders from someone else. These were, you know, people who all said that they were from the Donetsk region here, people, Ukrainians, of course, but they don't want to be a part of Ukraine. But that's the really good question. Who are these people and where are they getting their orders from? I was talking to some pro-Ukrainians yesterday who say, well, this is obviously coming from the security services in Russia. We've not verified whether that's the case. It's hard to do that. But they are dug in, you know, there's billboards and signs all with the same sort of message. So it's well organized. This isn't just sort of, you know, a small grassroots protest movement. It is well organized and they are listening to orders from above.
And it's not a peaceful sit-in either, is it? From what I understand, protesters are armed.
Indeed. You know, most of the people I saw, you know, yesterday and again today, there was fewer people there today, are not armed. You know, they're sort of run-of-the-mill people who have come taking time from their jobs or whatever, and they've come down to show their support. But there are a good number of men, and I have to say they've all been men. Here they're wearing mismatched camouflage or, you know, in a couple of cases, black balaclavas, black jackets. But I've seen a fair number of guns. I've seen lots of knives and, you know, whether it's metal rods, wooden sticks, things like that. We tried to talk to a couple of these armed people today, and they didn't necessarily want to talk to, you know, the Western media. But one man I spoke to said he will not give up his, he had a metal rod. He said he's not about to hand this over to anyone on the Ukrainian side.
Okay, so there's this agreement in Geneva that all militias, all groups with guns or metal rods will disarm, but nobody will. So where do we go from here?
Well, that's the thing. You know, here on the ground, no matter what side you talk to, no one believes that this deal reached yesterday is going to bring an end to the conflict. It's Good Friday here and around the world. So I went to a church and talked to some people going in, and a woman said, of course, she wants this to de-escalate, to calm down or to end, but she doesn't think that it's going to happen. And the real reason is that on both sides, there really is so much mistrust on both sides that who's going to be first, who's going to maybe offer this amnesty. The Ukrainian government, I should say, is working on a bill in parliament in Kiev today that would see pro-Russian protesters who lay down these weapons and leave these buildings, they wouldn't face charges unless they've been accused of murder or something like that. But no one seems here on the ground which side is going to go first. And as a result, they've dug in their heels. And from my position here, it's hard to see this agreement really doing very much.
The CBC's Derek Stoffel, thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Aaron.
So in the newsroom this week, we've been talking about Ukraine and Crimea. And someone asked the question, why do all these places end in opal? Like Simferopol and Mariupol, is it Greek or something like polis? And if so, why? Well, it turns out, of course, that the world's history guy, Chris Wolf, has all the answers. Chris, so is it all Greek to you?
Mostly, Aaron, yes. Sevastopol is literally venerable city in Greek. Simferopol means city of common good. Mariupol, city of Mary, after the saint. And my favorite is Melitopol, which is a grim industrial city, which means city of honey.
Oh, that's lovely. Why do these places have Greek names? Are there lots of Greeks there?
Well, not now, but there used to be. But we're talking like 2,000 or 3,000 years ago, the time of like Jason and the Argonauts and the ancient Greeks, when some colonies were founded around the Black Sea. For example, Odessos and Chersonesos were two, and they have become, or at least their names have become used in the modern names of Odessa and Kherson, big cities in Ukraine.
Okay, so thousands of years ago, massive Greek empire. Why would the Russian Empire want to make the connection to those ancient Greeks?
Well, it's deliberate. Most of these places were founded around the Black Sea in the quarter century after 1774, which was the year that Russia crushed the Turks and conquered that whole swath of what's now southern and eastern Ukraine and annexed it into the Russian Empire. And there's a deliberate policy that followed in, as they continued to expand, to basically erase the Turkish identity that was there before and to establish a new one with kind of more solid European connections.
And why Greek? I mean, they had their own language, no?
Right. But the reason you want to connect with the Greeks is, A, you're reaffirming that ancient presence there that the Greeks used to have. And you've got to remember that Greeks and Russians often felt like a common interest, or at least the Russians did, because they're co-religionists. They're all Eastern Orthodox. And the Russians always wanted to identify with Greek and Greek things because that gave kind of an ancientness and a validity to their territorial claims. So that was why Prince Potemkin went around renaming all these Turkish places with new names. Sevastopol used to be the Turkish city of Akçaa. Simferopol was Akmesit, which means white mosque.
So wait a minute. Prince Potemkin, we know his name from Potemkin Village fame. That's not exactly a great memorial to that prince.
Well, he was a great Russian statesman. He was a great military commander, and he was the lover of Catherine the Great of Russia and was rewarded with becoming governor of this entire new territory. So he kind of established like a state within a state, and it was his job to found all these cities, bring in immigrants, and make it look prosperous and wealthy. So that's actually where the term comes from. When Catherine came to visit her new lands, which were conveniently called New Russia, it's actually something that President Putin referenced yesterday. This whole region used to be New Russia, not Ukraine at all. It was added to Ukraine in 1922. And then he would build, allegedly, these villages to make the place look more prosperous and successful than it actually was, at least according to an Austrian writer who was not a friend of Potemkin.
So that is where the term Potemkin village comes from, essentially a fake place.
Yeah, a fake thing to try and make somebody look good.
The world's resident history buff, Chris Wolf, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Back to modern-day Russia now. NSA leaker Edward Snowden popped up on Russian TV screens this week. The former U.S. intelligence contractor phoned in a question during President Vladimir Putin's nationwide TV call-in show.
Does Russia intercept, store, or analyze in any way the communications of millions of individuals.
Snowden was granted asylum by Russia last year. His question during Putin's show and the president's answer are generating a lot of buzz. I asked Andrei Soldatov for his reaction. He's editor of the Russian website Agentura, which focuses on security and surveillance issues.
Well, of course, I was surprised because, well, you know that here in Moscow, it's absolutely impossible to get in touch with Snowden, and he never granted any interviews to Russian journalists, and we were told that he's heavily protected by security people. So that's why it was a big surprise.
And what do you make of Putin's answer? He said basically Russia does not spy on its people on a mass scale, and that even if it wanted to, it doesn't have the capability. Was he telling the truth?
Well, not exactly, because actually Russian secret services have technical capabilities to spy on Russian citizens. We have very sophisticated and advanced system of telecommunication interception known as SORM, the system of operation and research measures. And this system is very advanced. We actually investigated with Russian efforts to intercept, to store, and to conduct mass surveillance on Russian citizens. It's actually a development story because many Russian secret services now try to buy special programs to, for example, monitor social networks. It's a quite a murky picture, to be frank.
Do you think that Snowden's question or Putin's answer yesterday will spark some debate about this topic in Russia?
Well, I do hope, because we exposed last year the story about totalitarian surveillance at the Olympic Games in Sochi, and to be frank, it was mostly debated abroad, not in Russia. So I hope maybe now, because we got Putin's response, obviously we can comment on this and we can expose why he was wrong. And I think it's a very good thing because it helps us to launch a debate about these things now.
Should we assume that the conversation we're having now is being listened to?
That might be possible because you know that Microsoft, which now is the owner of Skype, actually has a very good connections with Russian secret services since the 1990s, mostly because Russian secret services helped Microsoft to fight piracy. And they always open at all things. So we should presume that Skype is not safe. To be frank, I tried to speak as open as I could just because I think that I just hate self-censorship. And I think the problem is that in the country like Russia, when you don't have established rules, what is allowed or what is not allowed for journalists, it's a very smart tactic for the Kremlin because you might inspire self-censorship. Everybody try to guess what is allowed.
And have you had problems in the 15 years that you've been doing this? I mean,
yeah, plenty of them, actually. Well, okay. I was summoned for interrogation. I was almost accused of disclosing state secret. When I wanted to publish my book about Russian secret services in Russian, immediately the printing house, not even the publisher, but the printing house was raided by the security agents. So it's this is a big problem. Nobody knows the rules. And these rules might be changed very rapidly. Just a year ago, it was almost impossible to accused journalists of state treason. Now it's possible. And now we have these new amendments that now journalists or publicists might be, or anyone who express some sort of critical things about, say, Crimea might be accused of harming national interests. And again, it's so unclear and so, well, unpredictable who might be actually prosecuted. So the situation is very unpredictable, I must say.
Andrei Soldatov is editor for the Russian website agentura.ru. Thank you for the work you do and for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Before we take a break, a sneak peek or listen to a story we'll have on Monday. Monday is a holiday here in New England. It's called Patriots Day, and that means bringing the Revolutionary War alive. Reenactors playing Minutemen and British Redcoats will square off once again. And if you happen to be in Lexington, Massachusetts, one of the Minutemen you might make you do a double take.
Apparently, everybody knows the Chinese reenactor in Lexington.
The story of Henry Liu, Monday on the World. Monday, of course, we'll also see the running of the Boston Marathon a year after the bombings. We'll be checking in at the finish line to see how the race and the city are faring. Coming up later on the program, tape of a famous speech from Nelson Mandela, almost never saw the light of day on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-Mile Run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Aaron Schachter. This is The World. Merriam-Webster defines magical realism this way. A literary style associated especially with Latin America that incorporates fantastic or mythical elements into otherwise realistic fiction. And today we mourn the author who, more than anyone else, is responsible for making magical realism so popular around the globe. Gabriel Garcia Marquez died yesterday in Mexico City. The Colombian writer and Nobel Prize winner was 87. Garcia Marquez, or Gabo, as he was also known, was of course best known internationally for his two most celebrated novels, 100 Years of Solitude and Love in the Time of Cholera. But curiously, the author saw himself as a journalist first and a novelist second, and as a realist above all. Here's what he once told the BBC about his literary style.
No invento nada.
I invent nothing. People always praise my imagination, but I believe I'm a terrible realist. Everything I invent was already there in reality.
Many in Latin America agree that there's nothing magical about the way Garcia Marquez described people and places, even if his characters were visited by ghosts or floated impossibly far above the ground. Writer Daniel Alarcón, a frequent contributor to our show, told my colleague Marco Werman about where Garcia Marquez's writing came from.
You know, he came from a tradition of storytelling and a tradition of oral history and exaggeration and a kind of cultural tradition that a lot of us understood, you know, that we all came from. You know, I remember when I was in Cartagena a couple of years ago and I was in a cab and the cabbie was like, "Esta es la casa de Gabo." You know, this is Gabo's house. And he said, aquí en el Caribe todos tenemos buenas historias, pero él redacta bien, you know?
Meaning,
here in the Caribbean, we all have great stories. He's just a good typer, a typist. He's just a good typist.
In fact, Alarcón wouldn't use the label magical realism at all to describe Garcia Marquez's work. He says the genre has simply been co-opted by too many lesser writers.
You know, there's nothing wrong with the phrase itself. It's just, to me, there were many writers who you know, would suddenly make cats very big or a girl whose hair wouldn't stop growing or, you know, they just add elements of surrealism and make that stand in for invention and emotion and real nuance.
Alarcón says what Gabriel Garcia Marquez excelled at was depicting a certain kind of reality, the kind you often encounter in small-town Latin America, where he says time moves at a different speed and things happen according to a different logic than what we're used to. That's what Garcia Marquez's fictional town of Macondo is like.
So I'll give you an example. A bus company in Peru, in Lima, turns out there's a bunch of fake buses that have painted their bus exactly the same and are running the same route. And they're not part of the company, but everyone thinks they are. And they're stealing passengers from the real company. You know, that's Macondiano. It's you realize that you're in a world with its own logic.
Our partner and founder of Radio Ambulante, writer Daniel Alarcón. The way Gabriel Garcia Marquez wrote about Latin America changed the way the region is viewed around the globe, but he also influenced countless writers around the globe, like Hamid Ismailov. He's the BBC's official writer in residence, and he says 100 Years of Solitude had a huge impact on him and other young writers in his native Uzbekistan.
One should remember that we were living in the Soviet Union, and Soviet Union was one of the most ideological places to live, very propagandistic. The whole world outlook was very bleak for us. And Marquez was the first who brought the color in this world. His 100 Years of Solitude was completely different to war, everything we were sort of reading about at that time. It was the sort of village life. You know, Macondo is a village in the middle of nowhere. And another very interesting point was it was neither the Soviet literature nor the American or the Western literature. It was the Third World literature. And it made us sort of look at our own roots and all of a sudden to remember how magic is our literary tradition is, how magic is, for example, 1001 Night in our literature. Mm-hmm. So it helped us to rediscover ourselves.
Hamid, Did you get a lot of books from outside the Soviet Union at the time?
At the time, he was not one of the disallowed or prohibited writers, because the Soviets, the communists, they thought that it's a sort of, you know, village life. It doesn't create any ideological harm, and they allowed him. But he was so popular. But then other books of Marcus appeared, like, for example, Autumn of a Patriarch, or Colonel to Whom Nobody Writes, and so on and so forth, which were absolutely, in a sense, anti-Soviet ones, but the floodgate was already open.
Did the fact that he was writing from Colombia, from the developing world, make a big difference?
I think so, especially for the writers at the edges and suburbs of the Soviet Union, like, for example, Uzbek writers, Kazakh writers. You know, once again, the village in the middle of nowhere was taken as the sort of middle of the world, the center of the world. And everything was happening somewhere, not in Moscow, for example, or not in St. Petersburg, or not in New York or Washington, but was happening somewhere else. So little by little, the value of the ordinary life was creeping in with the help of Marcus's books.
So it gave you guys permission to write about kind of the little villages in the Soviet Union.
Yes, and the real life of these villages, because what is called the magic realism, in fact, was the sort of, you know, the real life of ordinary people seen by their own eyes, for example. I myself, you know, made a tribute to Garcia Marquez by writing The Railway, The Life of One Station, where everything seems so magical, but in fact, it's just the real life, you know, seen by the eyes of a child. Once Marcus famously said that until I was 17, I lived in Macondo, and ever since nothing has happened to me. So basically, he returned to the literature this playfulness of childhood.
Do you think you guys realized more than others, perhaps, that, as you said, magical realism was more realism than magical?
Yes, for us it was, for example, what my granny used to tell me, you know, because the storytelling is so important part of human being, and with every story it's a human nature to add something sort of magic, something a bit sort of hyperbolic, you know. Every storytelling school everywhere in the world loves to you know, embellish, to make it much more beautiful stories than they are in reality. And he released this technique for the whole world.
Hamid, for someone who hasn't read Marquez, where should they start?
His classic is 100 Years of Solitude, but I would recommend his shorter stories. For example, Colonel to Whom Nobody Writes, you know, I'll start with the more realistic stories and then gradually go to his magic realism.
Hamid, lots to think about. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Uzbek novelist and the BBC's official writer-in-residence, Hamid Ismailov. You're listening to The World on PRI. I'm Aaron Schachter. Coming up for Kenya's elite runners, Monday's Boston Marathon is like the Super Bowl, and Kenyans back home will be watching them.
People know them. It's the same way you would talk of Brady or something, that he plays for the Patriots Sunday, yeah?
Tom Brady.
Yes, Tom Brady.
Plus, the Penguin Dance is sweeping Saudi Arabia and the world's newsroom.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-Mile Run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Aaron Schachter in for Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. When Nelson Mandela was on trial for treason in 1964, he gave a speech in the courtroom. It's the one where Mandela said he was prepared to die for the ideal of a democratic South Africa. That was 50 years ago this Sunday. It's one of the most famous speeches of the 20th century, though not that many people heard it at the time. It was recorded, but not for posterity. Joe Richman is producer of the series Mandela and Audio History, and he told me the story of how Mandela's speech in that courtroom was preserved.
It was recorded on dictabelt, which was, you know, used not, of course, to preserve history, but just as kind of, you know, court transcripts of the time. And it was kept in a box in the South Africa Department of Justice for 30 years. And by law, that had to be turned over after 30 years. And it just so happened that 30 years was 1994, the year that Mandela was elected and the transition happened. So this box went to the National Archive, and then some people who really cared about it, you know, managed to find these dictabelt recordings. And then the trick then, of course, was how do you play them? You know, there was one dictabelt machine left in South Africa at the time, and they managed to figure out that this was Mandela's speech. And then the machine broke quickly. So they had to figure out how to actually transfer and digitize these recordings. They ended up working with the British Library, which had one of the few machines left in the world. And, you know, it was quite a technical feat just to make this something that people could actually hear.
Now, you keep throwing around this word dictabelt as if anyone knows what that is.
You're not familiar with the dictabelt recording.
No, never had one of those at home. Explain what the tapes look like.
Well, it's actually, they're these beautiful recordings. They're blue with these plastic kind of belts that then could be flattened to play. It was made by the Dictaphone Company, and, you know, it was sort of used in the 40s, 50s in offices, you know, just for taking notes. You know, many trials at the time were recorded on these things, but they were never meant to actually preserve history.
When did you hear about this particular tape or these tapes?
Well, I was living in South Africa in 2003, 2004, working on the series Mandela and Audio History. And for that series, we gathered an insane amount of archival materials. And so we were combing every archive there was, especially in the SABC, the South African Broadcasting Corporation's archive basement. And that's where I first came across the actual speech. It had been digitized a few years earlier, but I had never heard it. I mean, you know, what's interesting about this speech is everyone knows those last five words, "I am prepared to die." But there are 10,693 other words in the speech. I mean, it was, you know, 3 hours long, 4 hours long with all the breaks. You don't just hear Mandela's words. You hear kind of the, you know, the coughs, and you hear the dimensions of the place, and, you know, it kind of brings you back to that moment.
Let's play a little bit of tape from earlier in the speech. Here we go.
I was born in Umtata 46 years ago.
Joe, this is something of an odd statement to be making in a courtroom where Mandela is fighting for his life. What are we listening to there?
Well, exactly. I mean, this, you know, he's starting off with his bio, and, you know, it was a very risky thing. People thought that what he should do is stand up and, you know, and make his defense. And he purposefully decided not to make any defense, but to make this speech from the dock. And even his comrades, the seven other co-defendants at the time, they were arguing that at least if he's going to do this, he shouldn't use those last five words that he did. You know, "I am prepared to die." But Mandela, as accused number one, as he was known, was representing all of them. And he was the one who stood up. And in many ways, this speech is what made him Nelson Mandela.
It is an idea for which I hope to live for and to see realized. But my Lord, if it needs be, it is an idea for which I am prepared to die.
I knew the speech well from the transcript, but to actually hear it, and as I said, not just hear the words, but to hear the dimensions of the courtroom and the coughs and the shuffle and the kind of the sounds, and to kind of bring you back to that moment, it's just amazing. And he sounds totally different. I don't know about to you, but it's just, not only is his voice different, but his demeanor is different. In this speech in the dock, he's making a statement. You hear it. He's making a statement to the world.
Joe, this is not the kind of thing you admit to an archive tape geek such as yourself, but I actually find the speech more powerful reading it than listening to him speak, because it's kind of slow, methodical. As you say, it took 3 hours to put across, and as I read it's just a bit more powerful.
I think that's really interesting, because I know exactly what you're saying. And, you know, the thing about that people don't always talk about with Mandela is that he actually wasn't a great speaker. He was an incredibly charismatic man, but not a charismatic speaker. And I think for me, what's so powerful about this speech is partly the words and the speech, but it's more the scene. You know, as a radio producer, that's what I get out of this audio. I'm brought back there and I'm picturing it, and I'm picturing the courtroom and him standing there in this moment when they really, you know, seriously thought that they were going to face the death sentence, and him standing up there and holding court literally for more than 3 hours. And I feel so lucky that we can go back and hear it.
Joe Richman is the founder of Radio Diaries. We have a link to his podcast, Mandela and Audio History, at PRI.org. In Nigeria, the Islamic militant group Boko Haram has been waging a violent insurgency for the past 5 years. Most of their attacks have been in the country's northeast, but this week the violence reached Nigeria's capital, Abuja. A bombing at a bus station there killed 75 people. Reporter Heather Murdoch visited some of the wounded at a hospital and met a family who lost several brothers in the bombing.
At a hospital in Abuja, 25-year-old Hamza Ibrahim stirs malt powder into milk for his older brother, who sips it slowly from a spoon. The brother has wounds on his head, arms, and legs, and is missing the ends of some of his toes. In a nearby bed, another young man nurses his father, a bus driver. Noah Bashir, the young man, says out loud what many hear only whisper. He's scared that Boko Haram have expanded their operations so close to home.
Me? I'm afraid, personally. I'm afraid. Like, serious, I'm going out of Abuja. I'm not coming.
He says he's going to leave Abuja and never come back.
Yes.
But others say if the capital isn't safe, no other part of the country is either. As his injured brother drifts off to sleep, Hamza Ibrahim steps outside the hospital and sits under a tree. Hamza comes from a large family. He says five of his brothers were at the bus station Monday morning when the bomb went off. They worked there, loading passengers into cars and buses. He says two of them were killed and two more are missing. Hamza thinks those brothers are still alive because their cell phones continue to ring.
Their phone, if you call it, is ringing, but you can't pick.
It's ringing, but they're not picking up. Hamza says he used to argue with one of the brothers who died in the attack, but he was close with 42-year-old Ahmed, who encouraged him to quit work and go to college.
The guy is very, very gentle. If he has something, he will give anybody.
Now that Ahmed is dead, Hamza says he will probably forget about school and just continue selling sunglasses on the streets. On the other side of town, some of Hamza's other brothers wait outside a different hospital. They found one of the two missing brothers inside this hospital, but he died from his injuries. They're waiting for authorities to release the body so they can bury him. In the meantime, they've also gotten a piece of good news. It turns out that the other missing brother went on vacation without telling anyone, and he's fine.
Even this one, people
even that, this one in the top 20 places, 70 people.
While they wait, the men argue about the death toll. The government says 75 people were killed in the attack, but they counted hundreds of bodies in the morgue in this hospital alone. One brother, Mutala, says he's afraid all the time now.
I feel well, I fear.
But Mutala says the family won't leave Abuja because with Islamist insurgents, sectarian violence, and armed robbery, no part of Nigeria is safe. He says the government is unable or unwilling to stop the violence.
I'm robbers. Accident, these bombings didn't happen anyhow.
He says armed robberies, accidents, and now bombings can happen any time. Only God will take care of them now. For The World, I'm Heather Murdoch in Abuja.
We head down to Mexico now, and I mean way down, more than 8,000 feet underground, to one of the deepest caves in the world. It's called Cheve, and it's located in the Mexican state of Oaxaca. Burkhard Bilger writes about it in the New Yorker magazine. He met up with a team of explorers who were descending into the monster cave. I asked Bilger to describe what that's like.
Well, the main Cheve entrance is spectacular. You go in this huge gaping hole in the cliffside, and it's, you know, it's a huge chamber, and there are rocks and kind of monoliths inside, and ancient Cuicatec Indians used to hold ritual sacrifices there, and there are a number of bones that were found of people who were sacrificed. So it has a real creepy and impressive aura. And then you do what is essentially is mountain climbing, rock climbing down these cliff faces underground in the dark, often with water pouring over you. And then you'll do a horizontal section where sometimes you're crawling on your belly for hundreds of yards or even longer. And then occasionally you'll actually get to a place where the water in the mountain gathers into a flooded tunnel that's completely filled with water. And then you put on scuba gear and you have to scuba dive those sections. And then you'll hit another cliff face and go back down again. So it's like that down, across, down and across over and over again.
Well, geez, that sounds like a whole lot of fun. I firmly expect you when I ask what's the point, you're going to say because it's there. But why do these people do this?
Well, there are a number of reasons. I do think because it's there is part of it. I mean, the fact that this is one of the few things on the Earth where you can actually see a place that's completely undiscovered, that no one has ever seen before, that's a major motivator. The fact that they kind of like being underground in an odd way. I mean, these are people who – it's not just that they aren't claustrophobic. It's that they actually love the feeling of being surrounded by rock, of that kind of womb-like feeling of having close contact with the Earth. So for them, that part isn't a problem. And then lastly, I do think, you know, there's this kind of camaraderie that develops when you are in extreme circumstances. And the more miserable the circumstances, the more kind of intense the fellowship is at times. And they have all kind of learned to crave that and to love that.
And it's also pretty dangerous, too, for a wide variety of reasons.
Oh, yeah. It is really one of the most dangerous activities in the world, maybe only rivaled by base jumping and a few other extreme sports. The expedition leader I was with, Bill Stone, his mentor was this famous Florida cave explorer and cave diver named Sheck Exley. And he rescued, I think, more than 300 corpses in his lifetime from caves. So it's a sport where, yeah, you die from any number of reasons. I mean, certainly with scuba gear involved, you can get hypoxia where you run out of oxygen. You can get narcosis. You know, you can get trapped in a tunnel when the rain comes through and floods a tunnel, and you can get killed that way. So there's that problem. And then there's the rock climbing level of difficulty where people, you know, the anchors come out of the walls and they fall great distances and land and die. So it really is just, you know, 1,000 ways to die.
Is this something people do on their own as a sport, or is this something you really need to put together a team to do?
An expedition like this really is a huge, I mean, they call it siege logistics. Siege logistics is the term they use for it. So it really is almost like you're attacking this cave as an army. And the team I was with was about 50 to 60 people, depending on when you were there. And I think the whole expedition cost $350,000. And it's not just that you need a lot of people, but that you have to have this extremely sophisticated logistical plan, because you can't just go down in a cave and go as far as you can go and then come back up. You have to do a kind of an Everest expedition type approach where you go a distance, you set up a base camp, you provision the base camp, you go back to the surface, you get more food, you go back down, you set up another base camp a little bit further, you go back to the surface. So you're kind of going in and out like a drill rather than one stretch.
You know, you bring up Everest, and I wonder, with Everest, you start at the base camp and you go to the top and you can stand on top, you know, and say, woohoo, I've done it. What's the end goal in a cave? I mean, you get as far as you can go and then there's more cave, right?
Yeah. I mean, that to me, I have to say, is probably the thing that I have the hardest time grasping, that there's no cathartic climax. There's no moment that you achieve where you go, oh, my God, I have done it. I mean, you could say that might be if you break a depth record. You know, if you get to that, you can do that. You can measure how far down you've gone and say, okay, now I'm deeper than anybody has gone. But, you know, almost nobody gets to do that. It almost never happens. So instead, what happens, you get down to a certain point and you just can't go any further. You hit a cave-in, or you hit a sump, you know, a flooded tunnel that you just can't get past, or you hit some kind of tight area where the water's going through and you can see to the other side, but you can't get your body physically to that other side. I mean, cavers, they're interesting folk. They don't have such a heroic self-image. They have to be able to say, you know what? this is a process. And this year I'm going to explore this tunnel, and if it ends, next year I'll come back and I'll explore another tunnel, and maybe it'll take me deeper. Maybe I'll find a way to bypass the blockage that I hit last year. And you have to kind of enjoy that continual process of discovery.
Burkhardt Bilger is a staff writer at The New Yorker magazine, and he wrote a really impressive article about the cave in Mexico called Cheve. Burkhardt, thanks a lot.
A pleasure to be here.
This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter. This is The World. Imagine sprinting for 200 yards. Doable, but tiring. Now try sprinting 26.2 miles. That's essentially what elite runners at the Boston Marathon will do next week. Go flat out for victory. The World's Bradley Campbell tells us what the presence of these elite runners means for Boston 1 year after the bombings.
It's impossible to think about the 2013 Boston Marathon without the lens of last year's attack. Just listen to the play-by-play hours before the explosion.
And the men's race is blowing up.
Absolutely.
Regrettable in retrospect, but no one had any idea what was about to happen. Everyone's focus was on the race. Fans watched as Rita Jeptu of Kenya won the women's event in commanding fashion. On the men's side, Ethiopia's Lasissa Desissa sprinted down Boylston Street to win by mere seconds.
Lasissa Desissa is the 2013 Boston Marathon champion.
After the race, Desissa conveyed what most everyone thought that morning. All is good.
Everything is good. People good. Weather is good. Everything is good.
The day didn't continue that way, and it's been a tumultuous year for Boston. But with elite runners returning to the city, they're helping to turn the focus back toward the race. And one country tied up in the history of the Boston Marathon is, of course, Kenya. Its runners hold both the male and female records. In Kenya's Rift Valley, which produces some of the top runners in the world, a Boston win is front page news.
There's a lot of prestige attached to success in running.
Nefat Maritim is a middle distance runner from the Rift Valley. He's now a junior at Harvard. We talk at the indoor track on campus. The Boston Marathon is his Super Bowl. He adjusts his entire spring course load around it.
I knew right from long ago that, you know, Monday, we're going to have the Boston Marathon on a Monday. So I made sure I have no class on Monday.
Nefat won't be running in it. He'll watch the race on TV, so not to miss a moment. The top runners are his heroes.
They are seen as really the only professional sport in Kenya that makes some serious money. You know, people know them. It's the same way you would talk of, I think, Brady or something. He plays for the Patriots, something, yeah?
Tom Brady?
Yes, Tom Brady. Yeah.
Nefat's not thinking about the bombing. He's thinking about watching his heroes do what they do best, run. One guy with the potential to become a Brady-like figure is Kenyan runner Daniel Salel. I met up with him at the Minuteman Trail just west of Boston. He looks like sticking bones on video, but up close, it's different. He's all sinewy muscle. Daniel runs a mile in 3 minutes, 54 seconds.
It takes much good and commitments to be a good athlete.
That's the key, commitment. Daniel lives a monastic existence. He trains, he eats, he rests, he trains, he races, he rests, he runs. That's his life. He's racing in the Boston Athletic Association's Distance Medley. It's a series of 5K, 10K, and half marathon events. He says he's still a couple years away from competing at the marathon distance, but that's what all his running is for.
So maybe my hope is to become one time a winner.
Sharon Cherop also thinks commitment is the key to winning a Boston Marathon, and she should know. She won in 2012.
Crossing the finish in 2 hours, 31 minutes, 49 seconds, Kenya's Sharon Cherop, our champion this year.
So many people were screaming, cheering. It was really a great day for me.
Cherop didn't run in Boston last year, and when I asked her if she had any concerns about running this time around, she said no.
I believe that what happened last year will not happen again.
And the more you talk with elite runners like Cherop, the less you think about the bombing, and the more excitement you feel for Marathon Monday. You start to see the race through the eyes of the racers. The main focus is winning.
It's really a great achievement when you win a Boston Marathon.
And when the elite runners fly down Boylston Street toward the finish line this year, they'll remind us the marathon is many things. But at its core, It's one incredible race. For the world, I'm Bradley Campbell, Boston.
And finally today, Saudi Arabia is not a place we normally associate with a silly dance, but something called the penguin dance is all the rage there at the moment. If you haven't seen it yet, it's a line dance that combines side kicks and bunny hops. Wall Street Journal reporter Ellen Nickmeyer has written about this, and she reckons the Saudi craze has its origins on the web.
Saudis spend a lot of time online watching videos. There's not movie theaters in Saudi, they're banned, and a lot of public entertainment places that the rest of the world has are banned there too. So Saudis spend a lot of time just kind of online watching videos. They're some of the world's biggest consumers of YouTube. So there are dances that show variations of the penguin dance online, and Saudis say that they saw those videos. And once it hit Saudi, it just spread. It became a very popular thing to do.
You know, I want to make a point of saying that certainly we expect that Saudis should have a home life and that they should dance or do whatever. It is the fact that they're putting these videos online that's making it so interesting.
That's true. I mean, I think I lived in Saudi for a couple of years, and my impression is that Saudis often care a lot about their dignity, about the way that they present themselves publicly. So the fact that they're willing to like show the lighter side of things, and some of them actually have done joke videos with the penguin dance where there's one where some guys are starting a penguin dance and they say, forget about this. Let's go back to our old dances. And they do some traditional dances. So it's, in a way, it's a way that, Saudis can just show the rest of the world that they're real people, too. Enjoy having fun.
What has been the reaction to this? Government, clerics, anything?
There's not been any official reaction to the penguin dance, but online there are definitely some people who are expressing the view that this is something that's a foreign import and it's not something that Muslims should do or Saudis should do. I've seen tweets calling it the penguin dance like a Zionist plot and saying it's like a Christian attempt to convert people to Christianity and that it's not proper for women to do and things like that. So just all the objections that are usually raised to anything from outside are being raised against the penguin dance.
Ellen, I wonder if the objections to the dance have to do with the fact that it's kind of a grassroots movement and not something, you know, given an official stamp of approval.
In a way, I mean, perhaps it certainly doesn't come from, you know, the clerical authorities or anything like that. So, I mean, the fact that it's outside the system, Saudi can be a pretty closed system. So anything that comes from outside can be seen as like a challenge to the existing order.
Now, Ellen, just between you and me, have you done the penguin dance?
I have done the penguin dance in the privacy of my own home for no one to see.
Ellen Nickmeyer, reporter for The Wall Street Journal, thank you as always.
Yeah, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Yes, even we tried the penguin dance here in the newsroom. It's painfully embarrassing, but worth a watch at PRI.org. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Aaron Schachter. Have a great weekend.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, GatesFoundation.org, the Ford Foundation, the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, MacFound.org, by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Linda Larson and Jerry Johnson, the Rose Family Fund, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and Roger Hale and Nor Hall.
PRI, Public Radio International.